Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust. And we have been broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, at the moment suspended, over a programme to do with Happy Cities a few weeks ago. That's on bcfmradio.com. This week we hear from the author Jacob Zaki, an historian. He will be at Bristol Museum and at the Lord Mayor's Chapel, taking us through Bristol's Islamic history and taking a look at Thomas Beckford. Also, Jill Golding. She has her grandfather Harold Golding's memoirs, and it turns out he was a war hero but died 3 months after the end of the war, and the Ministry of Defence tried to bury him and his role in history. Also, Rail Futures' Bruce Williamson looks at the HS2 project, now maybe costing up to £111 billion. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. And if you want to join in, contact the People's Republic of Stokescroft, just off Jamaica Street. The internet is prsc.org.uk. Or you can phone 0117 909 6897. I'll give further details at the end of the show.
Well, here in the entrance hall of the Bristol Museum, quite startlingly, there is this immense mural depicting a Sinan Deli, a procession of the great Mughal, on his way to the mosque, because the entrance to the mosque is round there on the left-hand side. And you can see it's built of Matra sandstone, which is the finest sandstone in the whole world. The tensile strength of this stone is so great that even telegraph poles are cut from it. But the domes are in marble, and that's Makrana marble. And the aesthetic impact of the mosque depends on the juxtaposition of these two contrasting tones, the red of the Matra sandstone and the peerless white of the marble. I've been there to that mosque, and it's shameful, you know, because with all the industry that there is now in Delhi, being the capital city of India, a great deal of pollution, atmospheric pollution, it's affecting the stone, just as it is in Agra, affecting the Taj Mahal. And huge lumps of stone were lying, fallen off the facade when I was there.
Now, also, I mean, one of the nice things about this is it's uncluttered, isn't it? There's no big tall buildings around it.
Oh, yes, yes. But you know that it was the British after 1857, the mutiny, they demolished all the buildings between the principal mosque and the fort in order to give them a clear line of fire from the fort in case there was another uprising amongst the natives. So that used to be parkland, and now it's like an open sewer. With the overcrowding and congestion, it's terrible. There's a bazaar there, and you walk amongst its narrow streets, and really the stench is terrible.
Now, it must be something like 30 or 40 elephants all in this procession. Would you ever get that sort of thing in India today?
The elephants are still there, but unfortunately, not for the ceremonial purpose, with the beautiful trappings that they have there. And if you go to the National Museum of Armour in Leeds, you'll find there a complete suit of elephant armour. In Mughal palaces, they had a special gate for elephants because they are so big. And it's called the Hathipal. And the great Mughal, in his palanquin, would enter his palace by that door.
Well, this enormous mosque in Delhi is almost like a cathedral. I don't know if in Islam they have an equivalent, but one of the things that's striking about it...
Cathedral mosque. It doesn't mean, in the Greek sense, cathedra, the seat of a bishop. It does mean the principal congregational mosque of a city, where they built big enough to contain the entire Muslim population of the city. Because remember, Delhi would have been probably a Hindu-majority city at that point, and you had a Muslim ruling class of Central Asian origin on top. And these domes that you see in the corners are called chhatris, which means umbrella, and it's also the name of a plant found in India. You can see it in the paintings of Abdurrahman Chughtai, the great Pakistani artist who died a few years ago. I had to give the memorial address on the first anniversary of his death at the Chughtai Museum in Lahore, and that was in 1976. Now, the chatri, as I said, means umbrella, and you can see it's quite distinct from the three domes of the sanctuary of the mosque, which are pyramidally arranged. That big one is on the axis of Mecca, so that people will be praying in this direction as I point right. And these are the side doors. There would be a principal door here, which is not in the painting, and two side doors, because the problem with the Islamic Friday liturgy is how to disperse people quickly who have taken half an hour or an hour to assemble, because at least in the Middle East, before the imam mounts the pulpit to deliver the Friday sermon, there is a reading from the Quran, which takes about half an hour, and during all that time, people assemble in a very gradual fashion. But then, when the prayer is finally over, then it's a terrible problem how to disperse the congregation when there are only three doors.
Now, you also got the towers.
The minarets, yes. And these are the balconies which would be occupied by the muezzin. And it used to be in Turkey where you had more minarets, sometimes even up to six, in the Blue Mosque, which was the principal mosque of Constantinople.
So each would have its own mezzin, would it?
Yes. And the azan, the summons to prayer, is chanted as a part song. So if you have three balconies to a minaret, and you have and you have four principal minarets in the Blue Mosque, that makes how many? It means you have 12 muezzins, and then you have two other minarets at the entrance, what would be over here on the left in this mosque, and they only have two balconies. So to those 12, you have to add another four. So you would have 16 muezzins chanting the whole thing as a part song. And it must have been really beautiful to listen to this. But nowadays, with the introduction of electronics and a public address system, this is not just a dying art, but one that is positively dead.
Well, why do you say that?
Because I myself have never heard it, although I've been numerous times to Istanbul.
So, yes, but, I mean, it must have made a great difference to have someone, hang on, to have somebody singing, yes. You know, or it is effectively singing, isn't it? Yes. I mean, yeah, yes. Rather than have a loudspeaker system.
Yes, and, I mean, if you go to the Middle East, where there's the overloading of the public address system, then, and you don't have proper maintenance of the electronic equipment, you have this grating sound issuing from the minarets, and the air wilts under the electric bellowing. It is really terrible. One of the few places in the Muslim world where you can hear the azan sung properly is Morocco. I was there a year or two ago, but I didn't, just a year ago, in fact, but I didn't remark whether things had changed. But when I first went to Morocco in the 60s, you could still hear it properly done there. And it was lovely waking up in the morning at dawn to hear this plangent sound flowing over the rooftops and through the windows into your bedroom.
But I mean, with the loudspeakers, I would imagine there's quite a lot of people who live nearby who would find it actually quite irritating rather than something kind of persuading them to come along.
There's a strange thing. I once saw an advertisement in Egypt for klaxons, and it showed that somebody squeezing a klaxon, and there was a man standing nearby going like this with his hands to his ears in agony at the sound, because in some countries people actually love sound, and there it was advertised as a good thing. We would think it very, very offensive.
I mean, at the moment in Jerusalem, I understand, and other places in Israel, that there are considerations from the Israeli government to actually ban these, the use of public address systems, ban these calls to prayer.
Yes, well, this is for political purposes, because the minarets can be used to deliver messages, you know, for people to assemble at a particular place in the city to form a demonstration or a procession. But in the case of Egypt and other Muslim countries, it's simply a case of not noise pollution.
Okay. Also, these domes you were talking about, I must admit, it look a little bit similar to the Orthodox domes. Is there any kind of link with the architecture?
Yes, there is, and even in music, there is an Oriental influence in Russian music, and particularly in the architecture. You're right. I mean, these are onion domes, which have those swelling contours. But, you know, these domes are not meant to be seen from the inside, because an onion dome seen from inside looks ugly. So there is, in fact, an inner dome.
So how's the lineage connected from architecture?
Russia has always been strongly under Islamic influence. Islam is one of the three recognized religions of Russia. And the Muslims got as far north as Kazan. I've been to Kazan. And although popular tourism depicts Islam as a religion of the desert, is in fact nothing of the kind, because if you go to Kazan, it's under snow for 5 months of the year.
Also, of course, Islam worked its way up quite a way through Spain, didn't it?
In Eastern Europe, because Europe begins at the Urals, it worked its way up the Volga. But in Spain, they entered from North Africa. And the base for the conquest of Spain was, in fact, in Tunisia. It was Kairouan. And it's one reason why the Muslims were defeated at the Battle of Tours. Otherwise, France would have been a Muslim country like Spain.
What era are we talking about?
We're talking 711, the conquest of Spain by Musa and Tariq ibn Ziyad. Tariq was a Berber, Musa was an Arab.
And how much of Spain was conquered then at that point, and Portugal?
The whole of Spain and Portugal, minus the Asturias Mountains in the north, because Arabs have never been instant colonizing mountains. They are agriculturalists and great agronomers, and so they cultivated the low-lying plains or the plateau. But the mountains had no economic significance, and had it not been for their failing to conquer the mountains in the Asturias, Spain would probably be a Muslim country until today, because it was from there that the Christian resistance was organized.
So some people say that the success of Islam was largely down to the impetus created by the barbarism of the Crusades. Do you think there's any truth to that?
It's both true and untrue. Islam is probably the most tolerant of the great world religions, because it's the only one that worked out a satisfactory system how to regulate the minorities by granting them autonomy, self-government. But as a result of the Crusades, when they first experienced the intolerance of Christianity, they turned inward and became a very introverted people, frightened of any kind of importation from the West, particularly the importation of Western education, because they said it leads to atheism.
So, but there were a lot of Christians would say that the Crusades weren't really Christian, that they were a kind of hijacking of the faith by people like the Templars. And the Vatican.
Certainly it's true that when the Pope heard the result of the Battle of Hattin, in which the Crusaders were defeated by Saladin, that he dropped dead from shock and organized the Third Crusade under William the Lionheart to retake Jerusalem, but they never succeeded. And it's very interesting that the chroniclers of the period, I have a great respect for those medieval chroniclers, which I had never read until I started to write my book on the history of Islam in Britain. And I had to deal with those churches, like the one here in Bristol, the Temple Church, those churches which were either founded by returning crusaders, returning from the Holy Land, and they built them as votive offerings out of gratitude for their lives having been spared in battle, or the founded by great military orders of military knights like the Templars or the Hospitallers. And the Hospitallers still exist. They have their own state inside the Vatican. So what is the Hospitaller state? It's a state inside another state, because since the Concordat between Mussolini and the Vatican and the Roman Catholic Church, then the Vatican is an independent state within Rome. And they have their own passports, and their own coinage and their own stamps. It is unbelievable because it means that, in a sense, the Crusades still exists.
For these school children visiting the museum today, do you think there's any echoes of these Crusades in the modern conflicts in the Middle East?
Well, it was a long time since I've been a school child. In my time, no, we were not. But here in Bristol, it would be a good idea to take them, provided the case is objectively put that what the Crusaders really were, they were freebooters. They were, even the aristocrats amongst them, were the younger sons excluded from inheritance under the law of primogeniture, which does not exist in Islam, where states are successively divided and redivided with each generation. However, there might be problems in teaching children the truth about the Crusades. Did you know that the chroniclers of the Crusades attribute the failure of the Second Crusade? It was a complete fiasco. In fact, of the 8 numbered Crusades, there was only one that was a success, and that was the first. The third was a draw between Saladin and Richard the Lionheart. But really, it was also a failure, because Richard the Lionheart stopped 12 miles short of Jerusalem. But what I wanted to say, there would be a problem in taking children around museums to teach them about the Crusades. And there is a full-blown Crusader museum dedicated to the Hospitallers in London, which is well worth visiting. But what if they were to tell them the truth, like how the chroniclers of the Crusades attribute the failure of the Second Crusade to the retraction of God's grace in consequence of the lewdness of the Christian women, because without FGM to save them, in that climate, they just went mad, went crazy. This painting is of great interest.
Okay, it says at the bottom here, St. James's Fair, 1824, by Samuel Coleman.
Mm. Well, when I was looking at it, along with a Welsh lady who converted to Islam, her husband was the agricultural attaché in Tehran. She converted in Iran, but he didn't. I was looking at one of the custodial staff here came up to us and said, "You get the point of this painting." We didn't. In fact, it is a recruiting sergeant who is trying to persuade a young man here to take the king's shilling and join the army. And somewhere here in the crowd, there's an elderly man, obviously invalided from the army, and who's shaking his head in disbelief because he has seen the real thing and knows just how horrid warfare is. And I looked this morning here to see if I could identify him, but I could not. You can tell it's Napoleonic period because the Regency dress is worn by the ladies.
Yeah, he's really saying that St. James's Fair in Bristol apparently used to happen regularly. In the 1820s, it was notorious for the crime and debauchery, but it doesn't explain what you've just explained in the little explanation here by the painting.
Mm. This is the man that the recruiting sergeant is pressurising him to join the army, and this is obviously his fiancée here, who doesn't want him to come back dead.
It's called the stoppage of the bank.
That was when 1825 market crashed, stock market crashed.
The stock market crashed in 1825. Many banks failed soon after. Rolinda Sharple set her narrative in a fictional Guinea Street, although several of the buildings here are based on ones in Bristol, particularly in Corn Street. Sharple's chose the subject because it was well suited to a great variety of expression in the many people who'd rushed to the bank demanding their capital and were now financially ruined. She exhibited the painting in London in 1827, but later worked on it again. I mean, this whole thing of finance, talk about that, because I know you have quite a lot of say about finance, don't you? And what banks going bust?
Not really. This is the field of my friend Darius Guppy, who has studied economics, but I have not. But people think, you know, that the credit crunch is something new. It is nothing of the kind. This is 1825, and there was a tremendous financial crisis in the 1880s.
Yes, well, that stoppage of the bank one, I remember moaning at them, well, must be 10 years ago, and they took me to see it in the basement of the museum, said, "Oh, it's not on display."
This is Verd Antique. It's a breccia, a complicated Well, it's a compound marble made up of various marbles that have been compounded in geological prehistory. And there's a mosque in Cairo in which the pillars flanking the prayer niche are made of this marble.
Well, that was Jakub Zaki taking us around the Bristol Museum and Art Gallery. Then he moved down to the Lord Mayor's Chapel to talk about Thomas Beckford.
Well, William Beckford was a man whose family home was Fonthill Abbey. I don't know much about him myself. I know that he did redesign and rebuild Fonthill, and Sir John Soames was one of his architects for that. But all I know of him is that Beckford went bankrupt.
I think it was Wyatt.
Was it? But Beckford went bankrupt, and in the 1820s, the City Council purchased at auction his collection of glass. So we've got several windows in the chapel that come from his collection, and several that come from another private collection, Sir Paul Bagot, all purchased in the 1820s.
Now, isn't he this guy that built this abbey up at Fonthill that then either got hit by lightning or collapsed or something within his own lifetime, which is amazing, really?
He built the massive tower, I believe, which collapsed because it didn't have properly substantial foundations. So the whole thing went down.
And so there was some glass left after that?
He had a massive collection of glass. He collected glass from all over Europe, as many people did. Much of it might have come from the palaces and private homes of nobles from the French Revolution. So the revolutionaries would have been selling off glass from the palaces and the churches, and they collected it to adorn their own houses over here. So we have that up there as a window he had commissioned for Fonthill. That's the Beckett window, which has a few things wrong with it artistically, but... And then in the chapel itself, the little roundels are part of his collection, and they're 16th and 17th century Flemish and German glass. But they're not from a chapel, they're domestic glass. And they depict the house saints of the various households.
And Jakob, what do you know about this Beckford?
A great deal, because his work Wathic, which is the Arabic Al-Wathic, one of the Abbasid caliphs of Baghdad, his book... recounting an episode in Wathic's life, probably fictitious but connected with Satanism, is the only work of English literature that successfully conveys the flavour of Arabic literature. And when Yusuf Islam, Cat Stevens, set up his Islamia primary school, I suggested to him that he should include this book in his curriculum for precisely that reason, because there are some masterpieces of English literature, like the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, or the translations of the Arabian Nights. The first translation was done from the French, not directly from the Arabic, but Lane's translation from Arabic is a masterpiece of scholarship, that these books should be included in the curriculum in order to show a link between Britain and the world of Islam. Because whenever we hear about Islam on the media, it's nothing but terrorism.
This Beckford chap, what was he up to, building his own kind of abbey out in the middle of nowhere in Fonthill in Wiltshire?
That's easily explained. His father's house was there, and that contained a Turkish room. So the Islamic taste goes a long way back. And that house was demolished. It no longer exists. And he built his abbey on an adjacent site. Like Horace Walpole, he was crazy about medieval architecture. But he also had Catholicizing leanings. When he lived in Portugal for years and he was connected with the ruling families there, he contemplated converting to Catholicism.
So how did he make his money to afford all this?
Oh, that's very easily explained. When his father died, he fell heir to the richest fortune in England. His father was a plantation owner in the Caribbean, I think, in Jamaica. He was fabulously rich. Otherwise, how could he have erected this incredible abbey in Wiltshire?
Do you know how long it lasted for before it tumbled down?
Just a few years. It collapsed in his lifetime. Uh-huh. And then he built another place for himself, a tower in Bath, and you can go from here to see it. On another occasion, I'll take you there. And the interesting thing is that he loved animals, and he left instructions so he is buried beside his dog. And when I asked the man who was doing the restoration of his tower there, and I said, because Beckford's tomb is just in the shadow of this tower. And I said, and where's the dog? Well, he said, that was removed when this place was converted into a public cemetery, which I think is very bad. Because some people, like Lord Byron, for instance, and Wagner, left instructions that they were to be buried with their dog. I would much rather be buried with my dog than my parents, to tell you the truth. Here you are.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name is Jill Golding, and my grandfather was Commander Harold Wilkinson Golding, DSO RNR.
What was his job in World War II?
He had various jobs, starting with moving agents and VIPs in and out of occupied territories. He was flotilla officer for Blue Beach, Dieppe. He was commander of the special boat unit, pre-planning officer for D-Day, naval intelligence officer, and Commodore Coastal Forces.
Now, when you talk about naval intelligence in World War II, one name comes to mind, someone quite famous, that's Ian Fleming. What was the sorts of jobs that naval intelligence people were doing?
I don't know the exact jobs that naval intelligence were doing. Obviously, they were going in and collecting Enigma machines and people, bringing back information, such as documents as well.
The Dieppe raid was a total disaster, and we know now it looks like that the Germans had some sort of forewarning that this was going to happen. It was a kind of precursor to D-Day. That was the idea. It was sort of testing out the opportunities of raiding the coast of occupied Europe. What was his involvement with D-Day? What was his involvement with the Dieppe raid?
He was the flotilla officer for Blue Beach, which was the beach that most of the Canadians went into, and there was a large massacre because we believe that the Germans were pre-warned for him going in. I don't know how much of the raid was a disaster and how much of it was just a raid for D-Day, or whether they were actually going in, separate people going in, trying to find information or get information from other parts. I think Dieppe was more than just a raid.
Also the possibility that they were going to try and get hold of an Enigma machine from the coast there. But look, one of the interesting characters you've met as part of this was somebody, John Ainsworth Davis, that your granddad was involved in training.
Yes, I met John Ainsworth Davis quite a few years ago now, just before the COP Memorial on Hayling Island was set up. Yes, I met Jad a couple of times. Fabulous bloke.
Just give us an idea of what was going on here during World War II, because actually the whole area pretty much was being used for training, wasn't it?
Most of Hayling Island was being used for training. You had the HMS North Knees, which were training the assault landing craft crews.
Hang on, because these aren't ships, are they? HMS, they're on land.
Yes, they're what's known as stone frigates. There were four of them, HMS North Knees 1, 2 and 3. There was the Royal Marines Barracks, which was at Milrythe Holiday Centre, which eventually became HMS North Knee 4.
So what sort of training was going on here, do you know?
It was training for assault landing craft, so large and small groups going in, doing combined operations and large operations. The COP obviously were training on beach reconnaissance.
Now, going back to John Ainsworth Davis, there are lots of veterans, not so many around now. You've met a fair few of them. What was so interesting about Jad?
The most interesting thing to me, obviously, was that he knew my grandfather, and my grandfather Harold actually trained Jad, and Jad told me about the training, and he told me about my grandfather, which was nice to hear firsthand from someone how they perceived my grandfather.
Amazing thing was that your father was trying to investigate what happened to your granddad, but he was getting nowhere. Actually, he managed to get very little.
I don't think he got anything at all. The government or establishments that he wrote to would just write back and say they were sorry, but they would not give out any information on him at all.
Now, he was quite high up, wasn't he, by the end of World War II?
Oh, yes, Commodore of Coastal Forces, a fairly high position.
But died so quickly after the war. I think the war finished 1st of May 1945 in Europe, and it was just about 3 months later that your granddad died. Well, what have you managed to find out about that?
He died a few weeks after the end of the war in Scotland on the 4th of August 1945.
What do you know about the circumstances? Because it's strange for someone who's in very good health, the top of their game, to almost keel over just within a couple of months of the end of the war. What do you know about what happened there?
Very little at the moment. We're in contact with the Lothian Health Authority. It's meant to take two to three months to get a response from them as to whether we can see the files on Harold's death.
Do you know, was there any inquest or anything like that?
No, we have asked, but we haven't as yet had any replies. We're still waiting. We do know that they have got a full case folder on Harold's care and his death.
What about your grandmother? I mean, what did she tell you had happened to him?
Well, she said that he had died, and she was told that he'd died from a tumour on the brain. She said she thought this was caused by him working underwater and explosions underwater.
OK, so it'll be interesting to get to the bottom of that. How have you been getting on digging out these records from the health authorities up in Scotland?
Well, we've officially been going since February, early February this year, although we did contact them a year and a half ago. But through the official channels with all the correct paperwork, we should have known 3 months ago whether we can actually see the files or not. Not too sure why we couldn't see them. After all, it is only about the death of my grandfather.
Yeah, and it's rather bizarre to think of various archivists and whoever up in Scotland being able to see these files, but the family aren't.
Yeah, the archivist herself, Louise, has been really very helpful. Couldn't have been more so. But she obviously answers to the Scottish Health Authority, which worked differently to England and Wales. And someone up there is dragging their heels. Whether it's intentional or not, I don't know.
Getting back to John Ainsworth Davis again, a lot of people have said that he was a fantasist. He wrote a book called Operation James Bond, that he was very unhinged. What were your impressions of you or your communications, letters backwards and forwards, and when you met him face to face?
In my opinion, Jad was a very genuine person. He obviously did know my grandfather. There were things he knew about my grandfather that he couldn't have found out through the internet or any other way. He told me things about my grandfather that nobody other than somebody that knew him would have known. I do believe Jad has told the truth.
But there are a lot of other people that disagree. I mean, for example, the official archivist in Hayling Island.
Well, the official archivist on Hayling Island really has one motive, and that is cop, and he's not interested in anything to do with my grandfather. In fact, quite the opposite. He totally ostracised him from any information that he puts out.
Now, one of the strange things about this whole business, Jill, is the way that you keep coming up against people who say that your grandfather didn't have a role in the Second World War.
not only did he not have a role, he didn't exist.
I mean, who has said that and why?
Well, I'm not going to name people, but I have spoken to various authors who specialise in special forces from World War II, and they just say that there's no documentation. They've never come up on any documentation about him whatsoever. The one real, true, genuine person is Quinton Rees.
What do you say to them, the people that tell you, but your granddad didn't exist?
Watch his space.
Okay. I mean, what evidence, though? I mean, can you actually show them something that's specific to say, well, hang on a minute, because he did?
As soon as the book's published, they'll be able to buy the book and they'll be able to see all the top secret documents and paperwork, not only that I have, but that are readily available in Kew.
What about the missions that he went on? What do you know about those? Because he was supposed to have been involved in more missions than anyone else on the coast of occupied Europe.
Yes, Major General Sir Robert Laycock actually said on his missions for taking agents in and VIPs in and out of occupied territories that he carried out more missions than any other officer of any service. That I have a letter from Laycock actually stating that. We know for a fact that he was on the very first combined operation and he was on many operations after that, and it states so on his service records.
Now, you've seen some of the reports from these missions. It must be, you know, it's really galling to have people tell you that he didn't exist when you've seen these. Give us an example of just one. What were the sorts of things we're talking about?
For instance, Operation Collar, I've spoken to a few people and they just say that he wasn't on there, but it clearly states he was.
So this is the official documentation. How has this affected you? I mean, you discovered this suitcase in 2010 with the secret documents in it, etc. How have you found it trying to get, in a way, history corrected?
Well, it started off really with I just wanted to know why he'd got the DSO. And then obviously what happens is you find one document, you find another, and then suddenly it becomes a story. And then you find that there's books out there stating that he'd done things wrong at Dieppe. And I have paperwork that clearly states he didn't. So I wanted to rectify that. Then there was the problem with the Cot Memorial and them refusing to accept that Cot came under the special boat unit from 1943, and in that my grandfather lived on Hayling Island, and they were putting up a memorial to the Cots. I thought that it would be nice for them to recognise their commanding officer from the special boat unit, but it was refused, and therefore I decided to look into the possibility of putting a bench up or something when Major Ian Matheson got in contact with me and asked me if we'd like a blue plaque.
So you have actually got some recognition. What is there now?
We had an event day couple of years ago now in the July, 21st of July, which was Harold's birthday, and we had a flotilla which went from Hayling Island Sailing Club up to HMS Northney 1, which is the north end of the island. There were four cockleshell canoes, the first time they'd ever been together, a Spitfire, a Dakota, and of course HMS Medusa, 1387. There are two blue plaques now, one for HMS Northney and all the assault lads that trained here and did so much heroic work during the war, and one to my grandfather on the cottage that he lived in.
So you've had quite a lot of knockbacks, people, an officialdom saying, no, this is not real history. What's your approach and attitude to this now?
Well, my approach is just to keep going, and I will prove that he did exist, that he had a major part in the war. He was one of the pre-planning commanders for actual D-Day as well. This has never been acknowledged. And I will keep going, and luckily I have a very few people who have been exceptionally helpful and keep pointing me in the right direction and keeping me encouraged.
What about books that have been published? Is there anything that you'd recommend, or authors, about the World War II commandos, the sort of naval side of the army in a way? People will look at it as... are there any things you'd recommend to people that will give them a bit of a broader picture? Because obviously some of it, there are big bits of history missing.
I'm not an expert on World War II, and I'm not a historian. I'm just a granddaughter looking for the truth. I have read many books. I found the one from John Ainsworth Davis very interesting, and it's one I would recommend people read.
Jill Golding there, talking to me about her grandfather, Harold Golding, who was commander of US Coastal Forces for the Royal Navy towards the end of World War II, but whose role, it looks as if, was covered up because his commandos were involved in a raid that he didn't agree with at the end of the war, possibly involving Nazi gold.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
I'm Bruce Williamson, and I'm a spokesman for the campaign group Rail Future, which is a body that campaigns for a better railway. And that includes things like high-speed rail. Generally speaking, I mean, the announcement this week shouldn't be any surprise to anyone, really, because it's simply the next phase of this very long-running project, and the fact that contracts have been let or open to tender or whatever is the next phase in actually getting the job done. Once it's been planned and the funding's been approved and Parliament have approved of it and everything, you've got to actually get... someone contracted to put spades in the ground and build the thing.
So the fact that it's the contracts are tendered out, does that mean the public are getting value for money?
That's debatable. HS2 is very expensive. There's no doubt about that.
How expensive?
Well, billions. I can't give you a figure off the top of my head. And one of the controversies about HS2 is that the price keeps going up. So currently it is quite a lot more expensive than the equivalent high-speed line in France. But, of course, you've got to remember that Britain is a much more densely populated and built environment than France. So to get a railway line out of London is very, very expensive, because there's an awful lot of civil engineering work and demolition and tunnelling and what have you to make it happen.
The way this has been justified, HS2, is that they're saying that it's going to save people a great deal of time getting from A to B to meetings and things. The only trouble is they haven't actually factored in the ability of people to work on the train.
Yeah, I agree. That's a slight flaw in the justification, because the whole purpose of HS2 is not actually to save people time. That's a kind of fringe benefit, if you like. The main purpose is to increase the capacity, because the existing railway lines from London to the Midlands and the North are running at capacity. And we're going to face a capacity crunch very soon, because there simply isn't enough capacity on the railways.
Couldn't they just put more trains on?
Well, you can't do that. There's only so many trains that you can put on a given railway line. And rail passenger numbers keep going up and up and up. And the only way to accommodate it is to build a new railway line. And if you're going to build a new railway line, well, you might as well make it high speed.
How are these trains going to be propelled? Is it going to be diesel, electric, what?
It'll be electric. All high-speed lines around the world are electrically propelled. Technically, actually, it's not true. The Great Western Line is technically a high-speed diesel line, but every new high-speed railway in the world is electrically propelled. And electric is the way forward. Whilst the overhead lines are slightly unsightly, unpretty, electric propulsion is the fastest, most reliable, cheapest way to do it, and it would be madness to propose any other way of doing it.
Now, I noticed the Chinese are starting to install these kind of maglev monorail trains that go even faster. I mean, isn't HS2 actually going to be old technology once it's finished?
No, certainly not. I mean, maglev, it's actually a British invention. There was a guy called Eric Braithwaite who invented it. But Maglev, I mean, we think of HS2 as monstrously expensive, but Maglev is much, much more expensive than that. And interestingly, the fastest Maglev train in the world is only slightly faster than the fastest conventional train. The other thing you have to consider, of course, is compatibility. So with a conventional train, you can have a high-speed line, and then the trains can divert onto conventional lines to make connections with other towns and cities, where if you have a Maglev line, it's a totally separate standalone system. There is this thing called Hyperloop, which is an American development, a sort of vacuum tube with a Maglev running down the inside of it. We'll see if anything comes to that, but that, I think, is also a sort of expensive pie-in-the-sky sort of idea, and I don't think it's going to come to anything.
Also, rail expert Michael Bing, he was commissioned by the Department for Transport to estimate the cost of HS2, which is bizarre that they've got to do this since they're actually already in the process of getting contracting out tenders and that sort of thing. He has said the cost will be, he reckons, around about £55 billion. But this week, he's now saying he believes phase one of the line between Birmingham and London would come in at double that number and instead be around £111 billion. I mean, it just seems like a vanity project, and a lot of people are saying it is.
It does seem like a vanity project, but I mean, and obviously I have reservations about the ever-spiralling cost of it. You know, we want railways to work and to be cost-effective. So I think there is a strong case for looking strongly at these figures and saying, well, what's going on here? Why are the estimates wildly out? It's only right that we get value for money from our railways. So I share some of those concerns, but I still think the thing should be built.
Commuters themselves say what they want is they want cheap fares, and they want trains that they can sit down on that are at the time that they want to travel. This doesn't really necessarily, it's not necessarily going to address that. I mean, there are, a lot of the commuters have been saying that this seems like a kind of top-down project rather than something which has been listening to the needs of passengers.
Well, obviously, I mean, when it comes to getting a seat, we come back to the capacity issue, and so HS2 will help with that. But I think it's unhelpful to think of this as an either-or thing. So we've got this new high-speed line, but we also need that ongoing investment in the existing lines, new rolling stock, increasing capacity where possible, reopening lines and stations, and electrifying the line. So all that investment must continue. I mean, I have reservations about, well, I'm very unhappy about the fact that the electrification to Bristol Temple Meads through Bath has been stalled, and the government are not giving us any commitment as to when that's going to happen. It's very important that that project goes ahead, along with all the other ones like Crossrail 2 and East-West Rail and so many others that are in the pipeline. Portishead's another example, that are so badly needed.
Will this connect up with the Channel Tunnel rail link? I mean, that's pretty important, isn't it? If you're coming into the UK from continental Europe, you want to be able to zip through London and get up to Birmingham and Manchester, etc., on HS2. Easily.
Well, yeah, part of the original scheme envisaged that, and actually the recent, more recent work has shown that actually relatively few people do actually want to travel through London and onwards on the trains. If there were to be, for instance, people having to change trains at Euston, there wouldn't actually be that many using it. But, I mean, I think in the longer term that needs to be incorporated into the plans, and I'm not entirely sure where we are with that. There was a rather unsatisfactory single track link that was proposed initially, and obviously I think that's fallen by the wayside because it was unsatisfactory. Of course, the other problem, of course, is the Schengen agreement, or the lack of it. So if you have European trains traveling to Birmingham, you've got to put in a customs post at Birmingham New Street, which is obviously going to be quite difficult to do.
You mentioned Portishead. What's happening with local rail around here? When are we going to see that line open again?
Well, sadly, that's another example of one of these things that gets perpetually delayed with ever-increasing costs. I think the most optimistic date currently is 2019, which obviously is frustrating and depressing because that line is so badly needed. And it's a really good example of rail investment where, you know, the rewards will be massive because the poor old commuters, I mean, Portishead, as you probably know, is a major commuter town for Bristol, and the poor old commuters coming into Bristol in the morning, it takes them easily an hour, sometimes more. And the train will do it in, I think, 19 minutes. So clearly the advantage, it should be a no-brainer, shouldn't it? So it's frustrating that investment and other similar schemes around the country and around Bristol are sort of stalling and taking time to come to fruition.
Also, it's about time the Metro bus is about to be introduced in the autumn. Is that going to... You cock a hoop about that?
Certainly not. No, the Metro bus, I'm afraid, is a monstrous turkey, a monstrous white elephant. And the basic reason for that is that the government is motivated to do public transport on the cheap. And on the face of it, buses are cheaper than trains. So what the politicians fail to understand is that buses and trains are not equivalent, even though you would kind of expect them to be. And some idiots within Bristol City Council, and yes, they are idiots, rather than saying, what are the transport needs for Bristol, they saw this funding and said, well, where can we put a guided bus? And they came up with this ludicrous scheme, which just diverts existing bus routes. And £100 million or more down the line, we'll have a Metro bus, which will be just slightly different from the existing bus service.
That's all for this week. Dialect's Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. You can subscribe and listen the week before broadcast at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Jakob Zaki, also to Jill Golding and Bruce Williamson from Rail Futures this week, and to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialect is a Bristol Broadband Co-op production. We're not on Bristol Community FM at the moment. We've been suspended over a Happy City broadcast a few weeks ago. But we were on every Tuesday at noon. Hope to be back soon. But anyone can contribute to the podcast. You can contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. That's on 0117 909 6897. Website is prsc.org.uk. Or you can go to the national volunteering website, do-it.org. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.